However, that extra dollar, if it was spent for a small percentage of high quality human beings that really want to do AM radio DXing, boy, they would buy it in an instant. They would love it. But that's a rare animal that wants to do that. What percentage of the guys you know do AM radio DXing, for instance? It's a rare breed. And so the manufacturer of the radio, he doesn't tune his cost-to-benefit ratio for that human being. As far as he's concerned, the president of the company says, hey, it's good enough. The average person doesn't know the difference. And it'll sell. And it's now competitive. We're running into one of those problems, I think. Let me go on to
Just one quick. The negative resistance effect that he mentioned, I have a problem with it, as it does not really fit to the conservation of energy.
He did not describe negative resistance. He described amplification. And yeah, if you do the right kind of feedback, maybe you can synthesize negative resistance. There's a lot more going on there. The main thing antenna's got to do is it's got to couple to the universe, so to speak. That's its first requirement. The second requirement is to then impedance match and couple to the rest of your circuitry. You got to fulfill the first requirement before the second one can really do the job. Adding negative resistance or feedback gain, adding regeneration in there might not be enough. But that's my first guess on that one, and we gotta dig a little deeper to find out what's really going on. Barry, N2MB, what's going on in Far Rockaway? N2MB, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, I hope I left that go long enough. All right, I'm not going to hold up everybody tonight. I just want to ask you a quick question. You and I had taken down a lot of towers many, many years ago, and I mean a long time ago. So before I even go into this, do you still have that tower? And if you do, I'm looking for about 160 feet of it if I'm planning some interesting projects around here. That's my first question. And my second question, my cat's sitting on it. Yeah, let's get with the first one first, and then we'll go on to that.
Those beautiful pieces of tower section that you and I brought down with a heroic effort and transported with a heroic effort, and you came close to becoming heavily injured in that process. That's another whole story. And I'm awful glad that you didn't become injured in that process. Those particular pieces of tower section, about once per month, I go out there and I say soft, soothing words to them. I feed them nothing but cookies and milk. They're in good condition, being well treated, and they're waiting to be applied to a worthwhile purpose. Over to you, Barry. K2RIW.
Okay, I can hear the laughter in your voice. Very good. Excellent. Now, the next question is almost scary. Did we have the good sense, and I'm sure we didn't, because we don't have a lot of good sense, did we have the good sense to take some of the guy wire with us?
No, we didn't, and that's not a bad one, Barry. Guy wire is dirt cheap by comparison to tower. When it comes to 6M guy wire, for instance, that's the quarter-inch, extremely high-strength, seven strands that's being used by every utility company across the United States. Lots and lots of reels of that stuff. They buy it in 5,000-foot reels, and with a 250-foot left on the reel, it goes back to the stockyard, and it sits there. And you and I go to the right stockyard, we can get lots of it for free. But if we have to go out and buy it by writing a real check, it's not that expensive. Yeah, that particular guy wire was a lot bigger in diameter, but it had been mistreated. It was in very specific lengths for those particular 100-foot high towers. My guess is each one of those lengths was exactly 150 feet. And hooking them together, if you needed more length to it, is not so good. So the fact that we didn't take the guy wire, that's the stuff that has only a couple of percent of the value of the tower. No, we didn't take it, and I'm not sad about that one, because I think you can replace that one pretty easily, Barry. N2MB, K2RIW.
Okay, real good. All right. I got to get together with you about the availability that some of the utility companies may have some that they don't want. That's a good sign. We'll look into that. And, okay, I'm not going to hold the net up for this because it's not commercial. It's in the realm of ham radio, and I am planning a fairly extensive ham radio project with it. So that's cool. Very good. Back to you, sir. Good. I'm so glad that you said that because I was thinking my way back tonight. When I first called you, I was in the car. I was saying, no way he's going to have that stuff. Well, it's pretty good, Dick. I know you don't have the dishes anymore, but I'm working on a dish not as big. It's about 18 feet, but it'll be good for 432 and 1296. I'm sure it will. K2RW and 2MB.
And Barry, those particular tower sections, each individual vertical leg can tolerate a compressive force of 85,000 pounds, and there's three of them. I think there's not likely you're going to overload those particular tower sections, although occasionally you think pretty big. We'll soon see. Okay. We look forward to hearing from you. John, what kind of emails have you had this week? This is now the section that used to be Mel's Corner, Mel, K2KEY, and now when new amateurs who don't yet have their license where they can't easily talk to us because the TechNet is a give-and-take on-the-air live question-and-answer period, and we educate each other, so to speak. John and I, for the most part, are not volunteering to give free consulting service during the rest of the week. We just can't handle all that. 4 hours on Sunday night for the last zillion years is enough. And by the way, we're coming up on 30 years of duration. This is TechNet number 1416 of the series that began in the middle of September of 1982. We think that this is one of the longest running nets under the same leadership, longest running in number of hours, running in number of years under continuous leadership. It may be a record, and as you guys probably know, 2 years ago, the ARL awarded the Technical Net the Technical Service Award from the Board of Directors. Okay, what kind of questions have you gotten this week, John, for guys that don't yet have their ham license? KC2WGB, K2RIW and the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Everyone on that. Dick, by the way, 52 weeks times 30 years, I think that number is missing a few. I know we discussed that before. Let me just drop and I'll go on to the first question.
Yeah, I probably missed on some of the counting in the beginning, and there were a couple of, just two or three weekends per year or per 2 years when the TechNet doesn't take place because of holiday, sickness, whatever. So that accounts for some of it. I know it comes close, but yes, we're missing some. Back to you, John, KQLIW.
Very good. Okay, Dick, I have a gentleman who has a problem with his computer speakers when he's on 10 meters. He has two computers, and he has two sets of speakers. They're not hooked up together. They're all individual. One set of speakers is not exhibiting the problem. He gets a terrible hum on one set. He's tried the ferrite beads and a few other things. He'd like you to give him some help on maybe some other things he could try to decouple it. It's really extremely bad, and it's not a real cheap set of speakers. He said, it was like in the $50, $60 set price. So and they're both about the same value, so he's tried so many things, and he can't even come close. They're the same distance away from the base station, and one exhibits the problem all the time. So maybe you can help him out. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Let me first ask a little more information, John. The hum he's getting on the speakers, under what conditions? These are computer speakers, I presume connected to the computer, and when his transmitter is on the air, he's getting the hum. Give me a few words on that one, John. Go ahead. And what band and what power, if you happen to know.
Yes, Dick, 10 meters, and he's running anywhere between 50 watts and 100 watts, but he even gets it at 20. Now, the interesting thing, which is going to be the major point, is even with the volume down, so that sort of gives you a hint of where that's coming from. And like I said, the ferrite beads did not solve the problem.
Yeah, this reminds me of the somewhat similar problem I had with the... I'm trying to remember the name of the very first synthesizer on 2 meters that was available, GLB, George L. Belkey, in the Buffalo area of New York, a real good computer expert, who came up with a digital circuit which would allow you to just turn a couple of dials where you could dial in the frequency that you transmitted, dial in the frequency you receive on your 2-meter transceiver. This was back in the days of 1971, approximately, when everybody had to buy a pair of crystals to get on a particular channel of the local repeater. You bought a receiver crystal and a transmitter crystal, and you had to have a great big rotary dial and the rigs in those days to select enough crystals, and you spend enough money and whatever. And along he comes with this frequency synthesizer, where you could now dial in all 800 frequencies, so to speak, on the 2-meter FM region. And the good news is that it worked like a charm, but to add TL tone to it was a difficult problem because the RF feedback. What's going on here is that even when the volume is turned down, many a circuit, for instance, the audio circuit in your television set, let me drop. Many television sets, you don't know it, but the power supply is this portion of the power supply that's on continuously, even when you turn the television off. If you think about it, you suddenly realize, hey, there's got to be a power supply on, and some of the circuitry has got to be active, obvious by the fact that I pick up the remote control, which transmits an infrared signal. The infrared signal is picked up by the infrared detecting diode on the front of the television set. It goes through a zillion stages of amplification and demodulation, and it figures out that you just gave the command to turn on the television set. And then you're going to give it a command to go to the next higher channel, and you're going to give it a command to go to the next higher amount of volume. Obviously, portions of the television are continuously active. The audio is continuously active for a very good reason. If the audio wasn't continuously active, when the television set got commanded on by your remote control, there would be a loud pop in the audio as its B plus supply suddenly came alive. The B plus, the push-pull amplifier, the class B in some cases, push-pull amplifier, is continuously running, as well as the infrared detecting circuitry is continuously running, and a portion of the power supply of your television set is continuously running. So your computer speakers might have a similar situation. Even though you've turned it off, you pushed the on-off button, a portion of it is still active, and as such, when the when RF is picked up, now here's the nasty thing about RF energy. When it goes out into air, let me drop. Any piece of wire, any piece of conductor in the vicinity is capable of picking up some of that signal. As it picks up that signal, if the signal is strong enough, it goes to the first integrated circuit stage. It goes to the first tube stage, if there was one. You get the grid cathode rectification in the tube. The first integrated circuit stage gets rectification. It changes the bias, and as such, all kinds of funny things happen with the circuitry. Now, the wiring to between the loudspeakers and the computer, that wire in itself is a beautiful antenna. And putting ferrite beads on it and wrapping it just right and dressing it just right is going to help, but it's not going to do all of it. The 110-volt wiring is an antenna. The wiring of the coaxial cable, the audio cable to the computer, is an antenna. And even if those were made perfect, the circuitry within the speaker set with its amplification is also active, depending on how strong the RF energy is. Now, if the antenna of his 10-meter rig is near the shack, that's going to be an aggravating factor. As the antenna is further away with the right polarization, with well-shielded coax cable, with good... in fact, there's something to respect. Make sure that you're using a good brand of coax cable, the connectors are properly connected, and the connectors of the transmitter on 20 meters or 10 meters is not leaking itself into the shack. So there's a... When it comes to electromagnetic interference, there's a zillion ways that can solve it. And if there's 10 things that cause it and you cure 9 of them and you still get the problem, you think you haven't cured anything. Until you cure every one of them, you get no success, so to speak. Let me drop. So, I do recommend a series of experiments in which you try to find out what is the true cause. I know it's not easy, but if there was a way of running the speakers, say, for instance, the power supply and its little wall wart, maybe gives you 15 volts. I'm picking your numbers out of the air. Gives you 15 volts, and your speakers really run on 15 volts. if you could make a 15-volt battery power supply, properly wire it to the connector on the speakers, and run it on a battery as opposed to the wall wart, that would be one hell of a good experiment. The fact that you can have the volume turned down and still hear the hum suggests that it's not coming from the computer. But there are various techniques by which the audio-generating circuitry, the sound card in the computer, could be picking up RF energy and coupling it into the external loudspeakers. Trying to think of some of the other things you can do. If the circuitry itself of the loudspeakers are picking it up, I've seen people line the plastic package, the plastic box that goes around the loudspeakers, the speaker circuitry. I've heard of people who have lined it with tin foil or copper foil or whatever to act as a shield, because to find the exact circuit inside that's picking it up would be very difficult. Use the brute force approach. And you could run that experiment by putting the speakers into a metal cage. You know, if you had a bread box, there you go. If you had a bread box that you could locate the speakers in temporarily, a metal bread box, and close the cover, and find out if you're still picking up the hum, that'll give you a clue as to whether or not the integrated circuit board and the integrated circuits inside of the loudspeaker amplifier is that what's picking it up. And when it's in a shielded cage, the problem goes away. So I know this is not an easy one, John, and I've only given you a couple of suggestions, but by step-by-step...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
By a step-by-step procedure, he's going to have to find out what is the true cause. And there's a large number of ways that signal could get in there. Drag your feet a little bit, John, in case we have other people who have had a problem, got some suggestions, and maybe they know a solution. KC2WTB with a delay. And make the delay long enough for the machine to drop out. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Enter Leo, Dick, and I'll leave a pause.
And KC2QIQ.
KC2QIW. All right, let me pick it up. Dick, I don't know how if you're aware of it, but the amplifier for the speakers is in the speakers on 99% of these computer setups. If he's getting in, if the volume control has no effect, obviously he's getting in after the volume control. So that kind of narrows it down that he's getting into the internal amplifier in the speakers after the volume control. I never took one of those apart, but I'm going to take a guess and say it's using a 5 or an 8 watt IC. Probably what's very popular, the chips used in car stereos and CB sets. Mitsubishi makes them. A lot of companies make them. I think he's going to have to do some bypassing. I think he's going to have to find somebody who has the knowledge and is willing to go in there and put a bypass cap in the right place on that chip. That's my guess, Dick. If he doesn't want to do that, I think I've got a bad connection here. Well, I was saying he's going to have to put a bypass cap in the right spot on that chip, and he's going to have to find somebody who can do that for him. In lieu of that, I know that the people who make the Rig Runner and the Rig Blaster, West Mountain Radio is advertising computer speakers that are immune to that type of interference. Worst case, it might be cheaper to buy a set of those. Back to that, and to Leo.
Rich, how long ago did you see an advertisement from West Mountain Radio? Because I think they went out of business 2 years ago. Back to you, Rich, after a delay.
They didn't go out of business. They sold out.
Go ahead, Rich.
That's right. I bought a Rig Blaster Advantage only this spring. They're very much alive. The gentleman is right. They sold out to some other company. and they are advertising, actively advertising on their website, computer speakers that have been RF proofed.
Well done. Thank you, Rich. Next person, there was QCQ and QIW in that order. Glenn, KC2QIQ, go right ahead with your suggestion.
Yeah, good evening, Vic. This is a problem I kind of looked into a long time ago because I've been running my computer next to the HF and the amateur equipment for a long time, and a lot of the problem being in the wall wart, I kind of determined pretty early that that wasn't really what was going on in most of these cases. And I had speakers that were working and other ones that weren't, and I dug into it to try to find out what is it with these amplified speakers that's actually where that makes one pick up the interference and the other one not. And the interesting thing was that I found that similar to what Rich was saying along those lines, bypass, but it's where they bypassed them that's interesting. Basically what they did was they took either capacitors that were like either 100 puff, anywhere between 100 puff to about 1,000 picofarads, but no bigger. And what they would do is they would take the plus, say the left-hand channel and the right-hand channel, the plus side of either one, and they basically return those caps right to the negative power supply on the board. So usually there's like a negative return somewhere on a ground plane on the board, and they basically just took the plus side of the left, the plus side of the right, and basically just attached a somewhere between 100 puff and 1,000 puff from either side back to that ground return, and that's what makes them quiet. Back to you, Dick. K2RW, K22QIQ.
When you said that's what they did, I presume the they means the speakers that didn't have the RF problem, and the ones that did have the RF problem didn't have those 100 puff to 1,000 puff capacitors in that location. Is that what you're saying, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RW?
Yeah, exactly, Vic. And what I did was I basically had the set of speakers that was noisy, picked up a set of 100 puff caps, and put them pretty much in a similar electrical connection, you know, just usually because they're very small capacitors, and just coupled them right on, and certainly the noise just completely went away. So I don't think that there's any real serious mystery to what's going on there. They're just basically trying to decouple the noise right at the high gain input side that's coming from the sound card of the computer into that little amplifier, and it's usually right at that input point right there. And it seems like they always seem to attach these capacitors right at where if you take one of these boxes apart and you look inside, there's usually a board in there and a cable that goes down to the sound card. And right where generally there's a shield on there, a left channel, a right channel, and a return. And usually if you pick up the shield and just have a capacitor attached from the plus left, the plus right, right to that shield with 100 puff right there, usually it becomes very much RF immune. Back to you, Vic. KC2QIQ.
Now, when you said plus left and plus right, does that mean the B plus input? In other words, if the amplifier ran on plus 15 volts, so the positive 15 volts going to the left and the positive 15 going to right, is that what was being bypassed right at the, as close as you can get to the integrated circuit that's going to amplify the audio signal? Is that sort of what you're saying, Glenn? Go ahead.
No, I'm not. That's sorry for the confusion. There's usually a cable that's going down through the sound card on the computer, and it's usually like a three-wire cable. It has a ground, a left, a plus left, and a plus right, because you know, usually going to a little stereo amplifier inside the speakers, inside those little speaker systems, and a lot of times there's a shield wire in there as well. And you follow that cable back into, it's basically the audio input cable going into the this little amplifier speaker. And you open it up, and you follow where that wire gets soldered right onto the board, the audio input signal, and look at where those signals are being attached. Usually there's one wire goes into the board for the left channel, one wire goes into the board for the right channel, and you have some kind of a ground return or a shield on the board. And just by attaching the 100 puffs right there, one to the plus left for that shield and one to the left and one to the right to that shield usually takes care of the problem.
Good thing I asked. Now I'm going to reinterpret the words you just gave me. Are you telling me that the audio input from the sound card of the computer through its cable into the amplified speaker cabinet where the speakers are located and its amplifier are located, I think you're telling me that if you take something like a 100 picofarad capacitor on the center conductor of that cable and shunt it to ground, so the audio is being limited a little bit by the 100 puff or 1,000 puff capacitor, and maybe the 20 KC audio is going to be a little bit lower in amplitude, but if it gets rid of all the RF at that point, it's a very good trade-off. So I think you're saying you're shunting the audio to ground right as close as you can get to the integrated circuit with a 100 puff shunting capacitor of the audio signal itself. Is that what you're saying, Glenn? KCQQIQ, K2LIW.
That's it, Dick. And as I said, it really, with the, I guess because the capacitor values are so low and the impedance coming out of the computer is also a low impedance that's driving those little 100 puffs, that really it doesn't, the signal doesn't really get much attenuated at the high frequency end, or at least nothing noticeable at all. But in other words, you don't hear any rounding or any difference in the sound into the speaker, but certainly all the interference that's caused by RF goes right away.
Sounds like a good suggestion. There's a man who's been there and done it and found out when he's got two sets of speakers, one that works well with RF around and one that doesn't, and he said, what in the world's the difference? That's what he found. Well done, Glenn. I think it was KC2QYW or something, QYW. Start off with your name, sir, and your full call letters, and your suggestion. K2RAW in the TechNet. My name is Dick. I was fairly sure I heard a QYW. One more call. QYW or something close to that? Who signed in right after Glenn? Are you still there?
I have a short question to Ben.
Maybe it was QIW. Was it QIW? Go ahead with your question, Wes.
Yeah, recently somebody asked me, he has a cell phone system and he has a wire that goes from the cell phone system to the amplified speaker. And the speaker is like 150 feet away. Now he's got on that speaker very loud music from local radio station. What Ben would suggest at that point?
Here again, Wesley, I don't know enough about the what exactly is causing the noise. It's just very fortunate that on the last question, when someone was asking about the stereo speakers in a computer system, that I've experienced it personally, I noticed the same response that gentleman was saying. Had one set of speakers that were completely immune. They didn't require any kind of ferrite cores or anything on the wires to pick up the pickup. So I really started investigating it. I took it apart and I found it. Unfortunately, every time there's some kind of a EMI type of problem, a lot of times they're not one glove fits everything kind of a problem. A lot of times you have to look into them individually and see if there's ground loops in the problem. Is it being picked up in the wires? Is it coming through the power supply? It's just fortunate in this one particular problem that I've already experienced myself. But unfortunately, I think you have to do a little bit of investigation first with whenever you have interference pickup problems. But sorry, Wesley. I'm going to have to pass back to Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
K2L.
K2 Yankee Oscar. Go ahead, Bernie.
Wes, there's two different kinds of paging systems used in the phone business. Some of them have powered speakers, and some of them use more traditional speakers and power amps back of the backboard. So you need to find out which type he has. He may have one of his powered speakers that's messed up. Or the flip side, he may have a wiring problem. That would be my guess to start, but ultimately you're going to have to get out there with the tools and check it out.
It's an old Panasonic telephone system. The one with the open door and the amplified speaker system is broken.
Are the Bogan, is the Bogan with a central amp or with amplified speakers?
Amplified speakers.
Yeah, I would try to disconnect the wire going through the speaker at the speaker and see if the problem stops. And that'll isolate whether your problem's in the speaker or on the wire going to it.
Got it, thank you very much. I was thinking about the filter on that particular frequency of the local radio station. It is mixed missing up in Queenies. And a question to Dick and eventually to Eric, should reporting that to the FCC help?
I doubt that highly. The broadcast station has got all kinds of requirements to be met for radiating the signal. The fact that somebody has defective equipment that's picking up a signal that's not intended for that particular service is not a function of the FCC per se or of the broadcast station. The FCC licenses things that transmit, with rare exception. I don't think they license things that receive. Yeah, there's a degree of exception to that. For instance, in the early days of UHF television, they ordered that UHF television capability must be added to a television set to make sure that UHF was not being bypassed. So that in other words, when people bought a television set, it had UHF capability into it. So in that respect, the FCC was limiting, was applying regulations to receivers. But except for things like that, I think the FCC does not regulate receivers or the electromagnetic interference susceptibility. Let me see if Bernie has an opinion on that. To your knowledge, Bernie, are there regulations trying to limit the susceptibility of consumer products? K2 Yankee Oscar, K2 LAW.
That one's going to be the outside of the scope of my knowledge. I believe the answer to be no. Glenn, QIQ would know much better than I. One thought that comes to mind, and I have dealt with phone systems around picking up radio systems, how far away, this is for Wes, how far away is the transmit antenna from their facility? And I suspect if you contacted Bogan, Bogan's probably had to deal with this, putting their equipment in high RF environments before.
Well, the antenna is a pretty much known antenna in the complex between the Metropolitan Avenue and what is the street behind it? The Metropolitan Avenue and the railway. That if you take a look at the map, you have a huge radio station. That I remember the problem with that was since 90s. In 90s. No telephone system could work with it unless at that time there was a start of the digital telephone systems by Panasonic, and this one was sort of immune to that, but the problem was everywhere in this area, and it's mostly commercial and tertiary.
As I see it, if consumer products have to operate in the near vicinity of a broadcast station, that's a tough requirement. And in that particular case, the broadcast station might not, in most cases, be at fault. That the consumer, in that case, having purchased a house in the vicinity of a broadcast station.
Okay, the distance is about 800 feet from the antenna.
Exactly. So the person purchased a house 800 feet from the antenna. The requirement is on him, the homeowner, now make sure that his electronics is immune, because the broadcast station, they're doing what they're supposed to do, radiate that particular signal. And yes, if you're near it, by the inverse square law, you're going to get some very strong signals. And so you either got to decide not to buy a house in that area, or if you do buy a house in that area, and if your real estate dealer is being truthful with you, he's going to tell you that you've got to be very careful with the chunks of electronics you buy, to make sure they have low susceptibility to strong local signals. And so I am guessing that the majority of the time that requirement is on the consumer. It's got very little to do with the broadcast station itself. Let's go to the next one, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
KC2WGV. Okay, Dick. By the way, Wesley, that an RF choke and decoupling would probably solve the problem. I've seen it done before. Okay, Dick, I have a question on a comb generator. A gentleman would like to know, what is it useful for? And are there filters that could pick out one tooth in a comb signal? Okay. Sounds interesting. Over to you, Dick. Let's see if we can come up with something on that one. KC2WGB.
I'm a guy who has spent more than 5 years of his life using comb generators, and I love them. The particular comb generator I used was used for calibrating a spectrum analyzer. We started off with a step recovery diode comb generator assembly. This is a tiny little chunk of electronics with a SMA connector on one end, and it was about an inch long and a quarter of an inch in diameter. And I guess at the far end there was another SMA connector, a female on one end, male on the other end. Inside of there was a step recovery diode. The particular one we were using was tuned to 100 megacycles. So you applied approximately a half watt signal at 100 megacycles at the input end of the circuit. The step recovery diode on each half of the positive half cycle of the 100 megacycles would be charging the step recovery diode. On the negative half cycle, the charge would slowly be drained out of the diode, and when the amount of charge in the diode suddenly hit zero, hopefully at the negative peak of the sine wave, it snapped. It's called a snap action diode, and it makes an extremely brief picosecond or sub-picosecond sudden change of voltage. And as such, when you look on a spectrum analyzer at the output of the circuit, you'll see a zillion comb lines exactly 100 megacycle apart. Every one of them is equal in amplitude all the way up to about 10 gigahertz, and then they start falling off to about 15 or so gigahertz. And if the accuracy of the 100 megacycle signal you put in was high enough, in our case, let me drop. In our case, it was a 100 megacycle fifth overtone crystal generating the 100 megacycles that was amplified to the half watt level and sent to the diode. We therefore had every one of these comb lines exactly 100 megacycle apart. All of them were, as I remember, minus 13 dBm of amplitude, which is plenty above sensitivity for a spectrum analyzer, all essentially equal in amplitude except for the first two. The 100 megacycle line was super strong, the 200 megacycle line had a peculiar amplitude, and all the rest of them, from 300 megs up to 10 gigs, the next, 30-some-odd lines were all equal in amplitude. Now, when you're aligning a spectrum analyzer, if you set up the spectrum analyzer so that it is adjusted for a sweep width of 100 megacycles per box, 1,000 megs across the screen, you should have a comb line that falls exactly in the center of every vertical line on the screen. So now sweep calibration became very convenient. If your gig tracking filter on the front end of the spectrum analyzer was properly tracking the sweeping of the local oscillator, the voltage-controlled oscillator, then all of the comb lines across the screen would be equal in amplitude. If the tracking was not proper, the comb lines in the center of the screen might be stronger than the ones at the left-hand side and the right-hand side. So you could do a tracking alignment, you could do a sweep alignment, and you could do exact frequency. In other words, if you went to the 13th comb line, and if the frequency readout of your spectrum analyzer read 1.3 gigahertz, you know you had high accuracy. And if it didn't, you know exactly how much inaccuracy it had. To pick out one comb line at a time is exactly what a phase lock loop does. Let me drop. There are many kinds of phase lock loop, so-called indirect frequency synthesizers, in which a comb generator is used as the reference oscillator, and then depending on how you twist the rest of the knobs on the circuit, you can decide to lock the phase lock loop on the 13th line, the 14th line, or the 15th line, for instance. Therefore, your phase lock loop would be putting out exactly 1,300 megacycles, 1,400 megacycles, or 1,500 megacycles in my example. Now, step recovery diode type comb generators, you can buy them in 100 meg intervals and 10 meg intervals and so on. So as a frequency calibrator, it is the more sophisticated microwave equivalent of what many of us have had on our old-fashioned ham radio receivers. There used to be a so-called calibrator signal that put out a signal every 20 or every 50 kilohertz across the ham bands, and you would use it for calibrating the frequency accuracy of your ham band receiver back in the days before we had frequency synthesizers. Back to you, John. KC2WGB, KQLIW TechNet. Wonder if you've ever owned a comb generator. They are fun type circuits. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Yes, I have an HP. An interesting little item. And it does work very well. Okay. We move on to the next one. Over there, Tom. Okay, have a gentleman who has his antenna up as high as he can get it. He's working on 2 meters and 440. He's now using RG58 cable, and he wants to change to RG8 if it might help him. He has a great SWR, and it works fairly well, but he's just not getting out as well as he should. Does it pay for him to go to the RG8U or LMR400? Do you think it's going to make any difference at all for him?
Yes. The only left now is how much. A good piece of RG8 cable at 450 runs in the vicinity of 4.5 dB per 100 feet when it's brand new. 4.5 dB per 100 feet is the insertion loss of RG8. RG58 at 450 runs something more like 12 or 14 decibels of loss per 100 feet. So if he had a 100-foot long cable and he's suffering 14 dB of loss now, and it went to 4.5 dB of loss when he changed from RG58 to RG8, his signal would be almost 10 decibels stronger, 10 times more apparent radiated power. If he's running a 20-watt rig, it'll look like he's suddenly running a 200-watt rig when he goes up 10 to 1 in power, which is what 10 dB is. And by the way, once you're operating on bands like 2 meters and 450, let me drop. RG8 is a definite improvement. The LMRs are a definite improvement over the RG8. Hardline cable is an improvement over all of the above. If he has the ability to use a piece of hardline cable, and yeah, hardline cable, if you went out and bought the Cadillac Andrew Heliax, you're probably going to spend $5 a foot. However, you can buy cable of the identical insertion loss almost for free. If you're willing to use 70 ohm, 3/4 inch, 1/2 inch, 7/8 inch, 3/4, 70 ohm hardline that's made for use for the cable television companies, boy, you get very low loss out of that stuff. Something like 1.8 dB per 100 feet. And because it's free of charge, by that I mean the cable television companies buy that kind of cable in 5,000-foot reels, and when they're running that cable down the block between the utility poles, when there's 200-foot left back on the reel, they stop that particular run and start off with a brand-new reel. And the 200-foot on that reel goes back to the stockyard and sits there for months or years on end. You get friendly with the guy who runs the stockyard. And for a very nominal fee, and sometimes for free, you can take some of those reels. And that cable, as I said, is worth $5 a foot. And in many cases, you can get 200, 400, 600 feet of the stuff free of charge if you just take it away. He might insist that you take away the reel with it, and you'll put up with a little bit of disadvantage. Or you might have to pay a nuisance fee of him, but once you know the true value of it. I told a couple of my friends, let me drop. I told about a couple of my friends about the fact that I picked up 400 feet or so of it free of charge one particular day. I told my friend about this. He went to a different stockyard of a different company, different cable company in his neighborhood, and that particular guy wanted to charge him a $20 fee in order to take a couple of 100 feet of the stuff away. And the guy said, hey, my friend Dick got it for free. Why do I have to pay $20? The guy basically said, get out of here. I told him, when he told me the story, you go back in there with hat in hand, you apologize to him, you hand him $30, and be happy as all hell that you're getting cable at $5 a foot, and you're getting hundreds of feet of it. Don't look a gift horse in the mouth, if you know what I mean. So, hardline cable, with a little bit of finagling, you can get it for very inexpensive prices. I'll admit it's a little bit difficult to get the right kind of connector to go on to the end of it or to adapt the things you've got, but when it comes to low insertion loss, that's the best stuff in the world. And that hardline cable is used by, let me drop. The hardline cable is used by the cable TV company with that outer polyethylene jacket on it. It's made for direct burial in the ground. If you want to run that cable from the shack underground to the tower that's 70 feet out in the backyard and then back up the tower, that cable will survive for more than 20 years on the ground. That is rugged stuff. The lowest in loss you're going to get, you could feed B plus up it and it'll have the lowest loss as far as voltage drop is concerned. And RF loss, it's really going to be low in loss. So the bottom line of all this, when it comes to VHF and UHF frequencies, the larger diameter, the lower the loss. The higher in quality of the dielectric material, when you go from polyethylene to Teflon, the loss goes down. When you go to foamed polyethylene, the loss goes down. When you go to air-filled cable, the loss goes down further. So you put it all together and you look at the 7/8 inch diameter or 3/4 inch diameter, hardline CATV 70 ohm cable. And by the way, 70 ohm cable has got lower loss than 50 ohm cable, even though it's a slight impedance mismatch on both ends. So, go toward larger diameter, lower loss, lower dielectric constant materials, foam for the dielectric, and hardline versus a braid. You put that all together, and the loss keeps going down lower and lower. You don't get gain out of it, but sometimes you think you will when the signals get so darn much stronger when you make these changes. So if you've only got a 10-foot run, you're not going to see much of an improvement. If you've got a 100-foot run, you're going to see a hell of a lot of improvement. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, great advice, Dick. Yes, I've used it myself, and I've stopped the cable company truck when I saw them working, and I got the stingers for a few dollars. So it's all doable, and that is a great way to do it. I would rather see him use that than to pay the price for LMR 400, which is quite expensive. He can not only save a lot of money, but I think he'll do better. And I wouldn't even worry about that mismatch between 70 and 50, because I think the gain that he's going to get, I think it'll make him happy. But he should notice a big improvement, because RG58, and he has 80 feet of wire in the air, so I think he'll find it an improvement. That's about it from Mel's Corner here, Dick. Let's go to Paul and see what he's got for the space report. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the easiest way to get around the problem of the 70 ohm cable with a 50 ohm antenna and a 50 ohm transmitter, and by the way, you are listening to 70 ohm cable right now. That's what's running up my 100 foot tower. So you're listening to my signal through a 70 ohm piece of cable. You could say what I did was to write the words 50 ohms on a piece of paper tape, slap that against the 70 ohm cable, make sure that that portion of the cable faced toward the transmitter and toward the antenna. And the transmitter and the antenna never knew the difference. Of course, that's a joke. When you really look at the bottom line of what happens with a 70-ohm cable on a 50-ohm antenna, that's a, something like a 1.4 standing wave ratio. That calculates to be something like 2/10 of a dB of insertion loss. The cable might be 7 dB lower in loss than the stuff that you're using, and you're picking up an extra 2/10 of a dB of loss because of the impedance mismatch. You can see you're coming out way ahead. And if you want to be a purist at some time downrange, because you're using the cable for a moon bounce separation operation, and every 1/10 of a dB of loss makes a difference when you're really pushing the state-of-the-art of moon bounce, you can easily make, at some later time, an impedance-matching network, a quarter-wave transformer, out of pieces of brass tubing that you get from the K&S company in your hobby shop. You can make a quarter wave impedance matching transformer that does a perfect impedance match between the 70 ohm cable and your 50 ohm antenna. So all kinds of corrections can take place. Let me drop. From time to time at flea markets, I've seen a guy show up with a 200-foot roll of 70-ohm cable, and he's selling it for, let me pick a number, $20. And everybody at that flea market passes by and sticks their nose up in the air and says, hey, that's 70-ohm cable. I can't use that. I've got a 50-ohm system. They think the transmitter is going to explode because they use a 70-ohm cable on a 50-ohm transmitter. They're really misunderstanding what's going on here. It's a strong misunderstanding of impedance matching and what VisWire really means. Okay, until you get to a 10-to-1, until you get to a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, even then you only lose half a dB. You don't lose half your power until the standing wave ratio is something like 5.6 to 1, some huge numbers. Okay, let's see what's going on in the space world. I bet your curiosity by now has already done some traveling, taken some good pictures. It's probably stereo pictures, maybe even with color. And tell us what Curiosity and the rest of National Aeronautics and Space Administration is doing, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
When Curiosity's doing good, yeah, that thing's gone almost 500 feet, they say, on the odometer. So that's what, beginning of September, August landed, so that was August 5th. You're looking at, say, 6 weeks, and it's gone about 500 feet. But the last day that it really traveled was on Thursday. It went 100 feet, roughly 100 foot in one shot, a little over 100 feet. And they're making some headway. They've used the DAN instrument to look under the ground to check for hydrogen, which would be able to detect water or water ice underneath the ground. They've done that, and they've tried all the different pieces of equipment, including some of the stuff that's on the arm. And, they haven't put anything into the test bed yet, the SAM test bed. Two testing units on board. I haven't read anything like that. But, they'll be doing that soon. Let me drop it. They've made tests with the laser beam shooting out of a mass cam and all kinds of different tests. Everything seems to work pretty good. One problem with the weather station, and they're getting around that somehow. So all is well for a potential minimum 2 Earth year mission, which would make it a one Martian year. It's going to go beyond that if it doesn't get stuck. I like the pictures that are coming back. I saw a nice one taken from the robotic arm underneath the, looking at Curiosity underneath it. I like all the pictures of the unit itself. It reminds me of when they first went to the moon on Apollo 8 and they orbited the moon. One of the most famous pictures that came back was of the Earth itself. Kind of like the self-portrait pictures of Curiosity, as well as the other ones, the other two robotic missions. It always looked good when you saw those pictures. And these pictures are even more phenomenal, I think. And there are stereo pictures coming back. I don't have my stereo glasses, so I can't look at that. Let's see, it's going to eventually go to this one place, Glenick, which three different geological features are coming together, and they'll investigate that. That'll probably take another 2 or 3 weeks to get there, and then eventually they'll go to the foothills of Mount Sharp, which is a 3-mile-high mountain. So much for Curiosity, Dick. Other things are also going on. Let me drop it. You have on board the International Space Station, Expedition 32 is actually left probably 1 hour before this net started. and they'll land in Kazakhstan probably about an hour before this net ends. It's not like when they go up. When they go up, they launch. It takes them about two and a half days to get to the space station from Baikonur, where they take off. And then they come back quite quickly, hours after they leave the space station. So, Expedition 33 on board. It's run by a woman. She's the commander. She's been up there before. She's done, half a dozen spacewalks and all over the years, many different flights. And there's now three people on board the space station, and that will change, I guess, probably early November. I believe another crew goes up, and eventually they'll replace that crew. So there you go for the International Space Station. We don't have any private crafts ready to go up until next month. They're going to test their rocket, and it's going to take off out of Virginia, Wallop Island. So they're going to test that rocket for a future, not too distant future either. Spacecraft, it's called a Cygnus spacecraft. That one's just going to be cargo going up eventually. And you have another Dragon spacecraft that's supposed to go up next month. I think the end of October or something. And then another Dragon spacecraft mission at the probably December, and many more after that. They have a contract with 12. Cygnus, I think, has a contract for 8. So a lot of unmanned flights going to be going up there. That's pretty much it. I'd like to see the commercial system move along. I mean, I think they're doing pretty good. They're still going to beat our predicted manned mission, by NASA, which would be 2017. On the O'Brien spacecraft. So that's a way away. I'd like to see these other ones get going. Back to you, Dick. WS20.
Thank you, Paul. Sounds like it's doing very well. And that radio telemetry that comes back, if you go to the right website by going to NASA.gov, NASA? JPL.gov, NASA.gov. Anyhow, when you Google Curiosity and NASA, and you go to the right web pages, some of those web pages will allow you to get further and further information about how the telemetry system works. There's a VHF path that goes up from Curiosity to the orbiters, both the European as well as American. There's also the X-band signal at something like 8.4 gigahertz, and the 8.4 gigahertz can communicate directly with Earth, but at a lower bit rate, a lower data rate. Let me drop. I made that one of the complete drops to reset so the Canadians can hear what's going on. The radio path itself and the repeating that goes on, I mean, you're listening to a repeater right now, and those orbiters around Mars do a beautiful job of picking up the signal from Curiosity and relaying it back to Goldstone or to the Deep Space Network of NASA. And that radio beam is amazingly important. In the case of the Apollo mission, Apollo 11 through 17, it's very sobering to realize, let me think now, even Apollo 8 went out to the moon, even though they didn't land. Any of those missions beyond Earth orbit, the radio beam is your only connection with all of humanity. That's a sobering thought. There's a VHF transmitter and an S-band transmitter in the case of the Apollo mission, so you get a little bit of backup. But if for any reason you lose that radio beam, the best telescope we got on Earth can just barely resolve a little white dot out there that's the spacecraft. And if you're sitting at the window waving your hands and putting up a sign because you're an astronaut and you're trying to tell the guys on the ground that, hey, I'm in trouble, the so-and-so is not working, they ain't going to see your sign, they ain't going to see you, and there's no rescue capability. You're on your own. Your only connection back to all of humanity, all of planet Earth, is only that radio beam. And if you think about the small amount of electronics that keeps that thing working correctly, how little of failure would be required for that radio beam to be lost. You think about what happened during Apollo 13. Let me drop. Where during Apollo 13, which was an extremely close to life and death situation, that all of the suggestions for take out this and use it in this way, and it'll keep you alive, all of that information was being sent up to them on that radio beam, and it was all unplanned operations, so to speak, if you know what I mean. They never anticipated that degree of failure. So the radio that you guys are learning about because your curiosity through ham radio, it's an amazingly useful subject. Just look at what we know about the universe. Radio astronomy has given us a tremendous amount of information. And a little bit higher in frequency than radio astronomy is optical astronomy. Optical astronomy has given us a lot of information. Ultraviolet, infrared, far infrared, gamma ray, and so on. All of these astronomies are all telling you something else. So to learn how electromagnetics works is really good. And now, along those lines, Wesley did give us a real gem this week, and that is on September 10th at 1:10 in the afternoon, one of the suggestions Wesley suggested we go to was about, his original quest was to find out, is light a wave or a particle? Let me drop.
Just one quick comment before you leave the space topic. Just wanted to see if you saw this one picture.
No, I probably didn't see the picture, and go ahead and describe it to me.